So Exodus chapter 11. So one of the things that it becomes really clear as we go through these plagues is initially, you know, the Bible didn't really tell us at the beginning how long the plagues lasted or how long they were going to last. The general assumption is that they probably lasted anywhere from 3 or 4 months to maybe a year. And part of that's because of the nature of some of these plagues and how they play out. So the reality of it is we don't really know. But if you think about it, even on the shorter end, let's say these plagues only took 3 months, 3 or 4 months. Can you imagine what it must have been like for Israel? They had cried out to God. This dude named Moses shows up, old guy, 80 years of age, shows up and says, "The Lord spoke to me in a burning bush, and he's going to deliver you and rescue you from Egypt." That would have initially been somewhat doubtful, which, you know, they had to be convinced. They did the miracles in front of the elders and whatnot to convince them. But now that they're convinced, and the plagues kind of start, you can imagine what would happen maybe after every plague. You see this amazing stuff that God does, and you get pretty excited. And then nothing changes. And then you get the second plague. And you get really excited, and nothing changes. And another plague. And nothing changes. Can you imagine what they must have been going through as they saw those things? How maybe discouraging it might have become to see all these amazing things that God is doing, wondering, okay, when's it going to change? You know, Moses promised us that God was going to deliver us. He's going to do all these amazing things. But, you know, hey, dude, we're going on like 3 months now. When's this deliverance going to come? How discouraging that must have been. But as readers, we know that God was doing what God was going to do. We know the end of the story. We know that God delivers Israel and takes them off into the land, and we have the kingdom of Israel. We see David and Saul. We know the end of the story, so we have the advantage of seeing all of that. But in the midst of all of this, I wonder how they might have struggled. Remember, they were in a polytheistic nation with many different gods who controlled everything. They didn't really know Yahweh as far as we know. At least they probably didn't know the name. They may have just known him as El, kind of a generic term for a god. They didn't really know a whole lot about this God, though. And what he was going to demonstrate, and we've seen this throughout the story so far, one of the reasons God is doing what he's doing is he's trying to demonstrate that he is a God above their gods. He is the one, the only, the true God. Their gods were nothing in Egypt. And so he's going to demonstrate that. And so one of his attributes and qualities is his absolute and total sovereignty over everything. And everything that is happening in the Exodus is dependent upon his sovereignty. Every aspect of it is controlled and timed and worked out exactly according to what God said he was going to do and according to his plan and his desire. And that's something Israel likely didn't understand or know about this Yahweh that Moses was now introducing them to. And that would have to play itself out. And so as we look at this passage today, I'm going to focus on that idea of God's sovereignty. What we have today is the announcement of the final plague. It's not the final plague yet. It's the announcement of the final plague. It's in chapter 11, just 10 verses again. And I'm going to look at, like I typically do, break this down into three pieces that we can sort of digest together. The first one is this, that God's sovereignty ensured Israel's deliverance. They may not have realized it or known it at the time, because again, we don't know how long this played out, but like you and I, if we've been promised something and it's taking a while for it to play out, you get to be a little discouraged. You wonder if it's going to happen, right? Well, the first thing we'll see is that God's sovereignty ensured the deliverance of Israel, everything that he had promised. The second thing we're going to see is that God's sovereignty ensured the judgment of Egypt and Israel's favor by God. And so we're going to see how his sovereignty plays out there. And then lastly, we're going to see how God's sovereignty ensured that his purpose would be accomplished exactly according to his plan. There were no surprises here. Everything was working out exactly as it is. I think sometimes we live our Christian lives, we almost at times might even be surprised at the way this works out or the way that works out. But it's no surprise to God. We had a saying when I was in college, God is on the throne, he stays on the throne. Everything works out according to his purpose and his plan. And we'll see how that is, how the stage is being set for all of that here, and how all of that should ultimately encourage not just Moses, but Israel in general. So let's look at the first part of that. The first three verses, God's sovereignty ensured the deliverance of Israel. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now the Lord said to Moses, "One more plague I will bring on Pharaoh and on Egypt. After that, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will surely drive you out from here completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold." The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. Now again, there's no record of Yahweh telling Moses exactly how many signs he would actually do. He did kind of give him a hint as to what the last sign would ultimately be, which is the killing of Pharaoh's firstborn son. But God didn't initially start out by saying, Moses, we're going to have 10 plagues, so just hold tight as we go through these things. So Moses has been going along with God here, doing everything God says, and God only tells him what the next plague is going to be. Go do this. Didn't give him a roadmap. But now, the Lord tells him, there's one more plague, and then the end is coming. Then this is going to happen. Now, we are told again in the very beginning that it would take the Pharaoh to be under compulsion before he would actually let the people go. That was chapter 3, verse 19. God says, he's only going to let them go under compulsion. He also told him, same chapter, that he would have to strike Egypt with all of his miracles, which I will do in the midst of it. So there was some indicator that this wasn't going to be a one and done. It wasn't going to be a very simple thing, that it would take God doing all of his signs, all of his wonders, all of his miracles. It would take putting the Pharaoh under compulsion, forcing him to let the people go. So even though the Lord didn't tell Moses there's going to be exactly 10 plagues, he did sort of set the table that it's going to take a little bit. I'm going to have to show my signs, my wonders. So up until this point, Yahweh had demonstrated his absolute authority and power over nature and all the so-called gods of Egypt. We've seen him turn the Nile into blood. We've seen him bring on plagues of frogs, gnats, flies, killing the livestock, putting boils on everybody, hail, locusts, and ultimately a darkness that was so thick they could feel it and they couldn't see their hands in front of their face. And every one of those, God has demonstrated his sovereignty over the gods of Egypt. He was, remember, humiliating them, showing that they're nothing. The plagues were all designed to do that. Remember, they had the locust god, and they had the god of the sun and the sky, and the, you know, the frog god with the frog head. So here God is demonstrating that he's totally and completely sovereign over nature and all of these false gods. So he's already been demonstrating his sovereignty, but none of them would have the degree of that sovereignty clearly spelled out as much as this next one. So he says to Moses here, one more plague I will bring. It's only going to take one more. He says that when he does that, the Pharaoh will let you go from here. But not only that, he's going to surely, he says, drive you out. It's kind of interesting. If you look at chapter 10, verse 28, just jump there for a second. Chapter 10, verse 28. I want you to see something here. What we're looking at in these first couple of verses here of chapter 11 is sort of, what I call it, parenthetical. Parenthetical. If you look at chapter 10, verse 28, it says, "Then Pharaoh said to him, 'Get away from me, beware, do not see my face again, for in the day that you see my face, you shall surely die.' So Moses said, 'You're right, I shall never see your face again.'" Moses didn't leave at this point. This What we see in verse 11, these first few verses, are sort of a flashback, meaning God had said to Moses previously that there would be one more. We don't know exactly when he told him that. It may have been while there was darkness on the land, the Lord spoke these things to them. And we're going to see that Moses doesn't actually leave until later in the chapter. So this is kind of reflection back that God had told Moses at some point during probably that last plague that there would be this period or this final plague where he would ultimately be forced to let the people go. If you look, how many of you guys have an NIV translation? Anybody here? No? Okay. If you did, there, it's interesting. The NIV translates this as, "Now the Lord had said to Moses." Meaning, it's not like the Lord is speaking this to Moses right now. It's that he had told him this previously. So, there's some slight changes in the different translations to kind of allude to this, that what we're going to see here is God said, this is sort of like, again, sort of a parenthetical thing, that the Lord spoke to Moses probably before this, and Moses is now still standing in front of Pharaoh. He hasn't left the Pharaoh yet. So again, verse 1 and 2 there are basically sort of, again, something that happened just previous to this. Now what Yahweh had told Moses was that he had this one more plague to execute against Pharaoh. And he says that he would surely drive them out as a result of this plague. Jump to chapter 12, verse 31. 12, verse 31. This is what takes place after the plague. Then he called for Moses, that's Pharaoh, and Aaron at night, and he said, "Rise up, get out from among my people, both you and the sons of Israel, and go, worship the Lord as you have said. Take both your flocks and your herds and as you have said, and go, and bless me also." So the Lord tells Moses here, there's going to be one final plague, and when I bring this upon Pharaoh, he's going to not just let you go, he's going to drive you out. And we see that in the end of chapter 12 there, where he does just that. Take your stuff. Remember earlier how he had tried to negotiate? Well, I'll let the men go, but you can't take anybody else. I'll let the men go, maybe take the family. You can't take the animals, though. He kept trying to negotiate. And what we see the Pharaoh do, actually, after this last plague, is take it all. Take it all. Leave. But do you notice something else that takes place here? He says that when they leave, Yahweh instructed the people to talk to the Egyptian neighbors and ask them for stuff. Did you catch that? "Speak now in the hearing of the people," verse 2, "that each man ask from his neighbor and each woman from her neighbor for articles of silver and articles of gold." Verse 3, the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. That means they did what they asked. "Furthermore, the man Moses himself was greatly esteemed." We'll get to that in just a second here. So basically what he tells Moses is, look, the Pharaoh's going to finally have it. He's going to drive you out. But guess what? As he drives you out, you're going to plunder the Egyptians. You're going to take their silver and their gold. Just ask them, and they're going to give it to you. And so that's exactly what Moses tells the people to do. Ask your neighbors for gold and silver. And it says, and God gave them favor in the sight of the Egyptians. So the Egyptians did just that. They gave them their silver and their gold. That's exactly what the Lord told Moses was going to happen. If you go all the way back to chapter 3, he had already told them this was going to happen. Chapter 3, verse 21. "I will grant this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and it shall be that when you go, you will not go empty-handed." Remember, they had been slaves. They didn't have a whole lot. They had their flocks and their herds, but they probably didn't have a whole lot. "But every woman shall ask of her neighbor and every woman who lives in her house articles of silver and articles of gold and clothing. You will put them on your sons and your daughters. Thus you will plunder the Egyptians." And God says that's exactly what's going to happen. He promised it beforehand. He now says this is exactly what's going to happen. It says here that he actually gave them favor. Hasn't quite happened yet. They were in the process here. And so he says that they're going to basically plunder the Egyptians. Chapter 12, verse 36, we see this actually start to take place. And the Lord had given the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians so that they let them have their requests. Thus, they plundered the Egyptians. It's interesting. They go from being slaves to now walking out with wealth. Gold and silver and even clothing, it says. They were able to put the clothing on their kids. Payback, restitution, whatever you want to call it. We find out elsewhere, I think it's in the Psalms, where it basically says the people were really glad they were leaving. So in essence, they were saying, yes, you want the gold and silver? Take it. Just leave. Just go. Get out of here. And why might they do that? Well, we saw a little bit earlier that the Pharaoh's own officials begged the Pharaoh to let them go. Why? He says, he's destroying Israel. He's a snare to us. Egypt has been destroyed. So they were thrilled to let Israel go. And all of this was under God's control and God's sovereignty. Now, it even says here that Moses was greatly esteemed in the land of Egypt, both in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of his people. That probably means that they had developed a healthy fear. And again, Psalm 105 is where the passage was that I just referenced here. It says Egypt was glad that they were leaving. There was the dread of Egypt had fallen upon them. And so what we end up with here is that Moses, even the way that the Egyptian officials and the people looked at Moses was with a tremendous amount of healthy fear. They were willing to do everything, do anything. They wanted Israel to now leave, to take their stuff and go, and they were so thrilled to kick them out of Egypt. It's take the stuff too, take our gold, take our silver. When I think about this and how it might apply to us, I think a takeaway might be that just as God's sovereignty ensured Israel's deliverance from their slavery in Egypt, His sovereignty ensures our deliverance from sin and death as well. You know, it's interesting. You know, I often joke around and say, you know, why didn't God just suck us up out of here with a giant Hoover when He saved us? You know, we kind of have to wait in some respects for our ultimate deliverance, don't we? You know, we've been told we've been freed from sin, sickness, disease, but yet at the same token we struggle still with sin, sickness, and disease. You know, we've been told that Jesus would come back and take us home, and we've been waiting almost 2,000 years. You ever get a little bit discouraged? Do you ever think to yourself, man, you know what, I wish I didn't have to deal with this, I think Dustin calls it this meat suit, this body of sin that I still live in, you know? The meat suit? You know, my pastor uses a less obtuse phrase, this tent, you know? But I think about even our culture and our society around us and how, you know, it used to be there was a time where almost everybody believed in a divine being, believed in God, you know. I've been doing a lot of reading on the founding fathers of our country and just a bunch of Christian history stuff. And it's amazing how even the deist and even somebody like Thomas Jefferson, who basically, you know, cut pieces and chunks out of the Bible and came up with his own version of Christianity, they still had this understanding of God being sovereign. They referred to it as the providence of God and His control over all things. And so we've strayed so far from that, haven't we? And I think that even affects us sometimes as Christians. We have a tendency to sometimes forget about God's purpose and God's plan and His sovereignty in accomplishing all of that, that we are simply here to serve and to honor Him and to be a part of that purpose and that plan. But again, when we think about our own deliverance, we haven't fully received or even experienced that full deliverance yet, have we? I still struggle sometimes with sin, right? We all do. And I get sick of it. I get tired of it. I get discouraged sometimes, you know? But I got to thinking about some of this and just the promise and the hope that we have that God will ultimately someday complete what He's promised us He'll complete. Jesus will indeed come back. All of the things that we know of eschatology with what God is going to do in the future, with Jesus coming back and reigning on his throne and the whole thousand-year millennium, all of that stuff, we can sometimes sort of become discouraged wondering if it's ever going to happen. And yet God's sovereignty ensures that it will. Everything he's ever said he was going to do, he's done. So we should assume that with the things that are still in the future. I thought of basically, as I think about specifically the promise of our own deliverance from sin and death and what we have that waits for us, there's five assurances. There's probably more that you can come up with, but there's five assurances regarding our salvation that are all tied to God's sovereignty. One of them is he planned it. He planned our salvation. Ephesians chapter 1 verse 4 says, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world that we should be holy and blameless. God planned our salvation individually, yours and mine. It says he chose us in him even before the foundation of the world. Now that boggles my mind. Didn't I choose him? Yes, but he chose me. I don't know how that all plays out. So God's sovereignty, in his sovereignty, he planned our salvation. He also initiated our salvation. Romans chapter 5 verse 8 says that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. God initiated our salvation too. Why? Because he's sovereign. He didn't wait for us to say, huh, you know what, I think I need to be saved, Lord. He initiated it. He chose us while we were yet sinners. Third thing, he works out our salvation. It really isn't so much up to us, it's up to him. Romans chapter 8, verses 29 and 30 says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to become conformed to the image of his Son, so that he would be the firstborn among many brethren. And these whom he predestined, he also called. And these whom he called, he also justified. And these whom he justified, he also glorified. Think about that for a minute. That word glorified is speaking of a future thing, but Paul wrote about it in Romans as if it's a done thing already. Why is that? God's sovereign. The fact that he foreknew us, the fact that he predestined us, the fact that he made us firstborn among our brethren, the fact that he predestined us, he's called us, all of those things. He will glorify us. Why? Because he's sovereign. A fourth thing that we can associate with his sovereignty regarding our salvation is that he also keeps our salvation. 1 Peter chapter 1 verse 5 says that we are kept by the power of God through faith for salvation, ready to be revealed. God keeps us saved. I'm not ashamed to say I am a once saved, always saved individual. I don't believe that we can lose our salvation. If we have genuinely been born again, if we have genuinely been redeemed, justified, sanctified, I don't believe we can lose our salvation. I don't believe we can give up our salvation. You might say, what about those people that seem to deconstruct and everything else? I would argue they're not genuinely saved to start with. There's all kinds of counterfeit. There's counterfeit faith. People that look and act as if they're saved that genuinely, really, truly aren't. But for those who have been truly born again, we're told here, we are kept by the power of God. His sovereignty. That ought to offer us hope and assurance of our salvation. It should motivate us to obedience. It should motivate us to love, honor, and serve him. The fifth assurance tied to our salvation and God's sovereignty is that he will complete it. He completes our salvation. So not only does he plan it, initiate it, works it out, keeps it, he also completes it. Philippians chapter 1 verse 6 says, he who began a good work in you will carry it out to completion. What God starts, he finishes. How many of you have started a project at home? Still sitting there incomplete. No, it wouldn't be Dustin.
Why are you poking me?
Yeah. God's not that way. What he starts, he completes. What he started with Moses, he told him in the very beginning, guess what? I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to send you out of here with stuff, gold and silver. You're going to plunder the Egyptians. It's going to take a little bit, but I'm telling you, Pharaoh's going to send you out of here. It's exactly what he did. We know the end of the story. And it's the same thing with our salvation. We can be sure that God will complete our salvation because he is totally and completely sovereign. And that ought to give us assurance. So we see how his sovereignty guaranteed or ensured that Israel would ultimately be delivered from Egypt and be taken to the promised land. That's what he's been doing this whole time. And what we see today in this chapter here is God initially announcing that. Moses, the end is coming now. What I promised you in the beginning is now coming to fruition. It's playing out exactly as I said it would play out. And it's because I'm sovereign. Next thing we see here is God's sovereignty ensured judgment upon Israel, but also favor upon Israel. Look at verses 4 through 8. Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I'm going out into the midst of Egypt, and on all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the millstone, and the firstborn of the cattle as well. Moreover, there shall be a great cry in all the land of Egypt, such as there has not been before, and such has never, or such shall never be again. But against any of the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark, whether against man or beast, that you may understand how the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. All these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, 'Go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out.'" And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. So this is when Moses actually finally leaves. So we see here that God's sovereignty is going to ensure his judgment upon Egypt, but his favor upon Israel. What do I mean by that? Well, throughout the Old Testament, Yahweh referred to Israel as his own possession among all the nations of earth. He told them he would bestow his favor upon them like no other nation. They were to be a holy nation set apart to him. They'd be his people, and he would be their God. We see that repeated numerous times. Exodus chapter 6, verse 8 says that he would take you for my people, and I will be your God, and you shall know that I am Yahweh your God, who brought you out from under the hard labors of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land which I swore to give Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I will give it to you for a possession. I am Yahweh. So what we see in this last plague is God displaying not just his judgment upon Egypt, but his favor upon Israel. This final plague here was going to be the most severe of all. He says about midnight, he was going to go out into the land of Egypt. And essentially, every firstborn in Egypt, of the Egyptians, both adult and children, of their cattle and livestock, the firstborn would die. It says here, the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, but even the firstborn of the servant girl who's behind the millstone, and the firstborn of the cattle. He said it would be so great that there'd be a cry in all of Egypt such as there had never been throughout Egypt. We learn later in chapter 12 that there wasn't a single home among the Egyptians that didn't have somebody dead. Now think about this for a minute. What we know of Egypt at this time was there was probably a couple of million people. Some estimates are between 2 and maybe 4 million. Imagine how many dead that would be. And it wasn't just the children. If you were a firstborn male adult, it included you as well. Every firstborn. Now the question would be, and people have asked this, and Dustin and I debated this. I think we even arm wrestled over it. Did it include only firstborn males, or was it all firstborns? I'm of the understanding that it was firstborn males only, and there's a number of reasons for that. I don't know if we ever... Who won the arm wrestling match? I don't know.
Who always wins?
Usually me. Just because I'm a bully. That's the way it works, right? It's been debated by some of the best scholars. The reason there's a debate over it is because the Hebrew text doesn't say firstborn sons. It just says firstborn, or firstborns, plural. And the plural form can be used of both male and females when they're grouped together. Okay, it's kind of like parents. You know, if you're going to use the word parent, say in Greek, when you're talking about male and female, you're going to use the male form, the plural male form of the word. And so it's hard to say, is this just firstborn males or firstborn females? However, in almost every single case in the Old Testament, I think, let me get it right here, only 6 instances in the Old Testament where firstborn refers to females. In every other instance, it appears to apply primarily to firstborn males. Again, it is used of firstborn females, but only 6 times that I can tell. The other thing you have to keep in mind is that one of the ways God asked Israel to commemorate this event was to sacrifice firstborn male, not sacrifice, good grief, to consecrate firstborn males. And that's really clear in the text. So the fact that God said, to remember this event, I need you to consecrate, set apart firstborn males, would imply that it was only firstborn males that were killed in the last plague here. The other thing I would add to it is God did tell Yahweh, I'm going to kill your firstborn male. He didn't just say, I'm going to kill your firstborn, but did tell him he's going to kill his firstborn son. So I'm of the impression, and I think this is probably the majority position within scholarship, is that this plague really was targeted at only firstborn male children in Egypt and the livestock. So you can disagree with that. I don't think it changes a lot. But it seems to be that God was specifically targeting the firstborn male. And there's good reasons for that, because the firstborn male played a significant role, especially, and not just in ancient Near Eastern culture, but especially within the Egyptian culture. But what we do see here is that the only ones that would be spared were the Israelites. Didn't affect them. He makes a distinction. In fact, if you look at verse 7, I think it is here, it says, but against the sons of Israel, a dog will not even bark. It appears that that's probably an idiom, basically a common saying, that no injury, no harm in any way would come to Israel. In fact, so much so that a dog wouldn't even growl or bark. Or we've got this neighbor, and they've always done these, I guess you might call them shelter dogs. And they've always had anywhere from 2 to 3 of them at a time. And I don't know what it is, but they have always been barkers. I mean, I walk out in the backyard, and these dogs are at the fence. They leave their sliding doors to their patio or whatever open, a crack, so the dogs can come in and out of the house all day long. And literally, every time I go out there to mow the lawn or walk in the yard, they come up to the fence and they're just growling and snarling. And I have tried, I've given them treats, I've been friendly to them, you know. They hate everybody, it seems. I don't know, they must be okay in the house with the family and stuff. But that's kind of the idea there. I walk out of the house and the dogs are like, arr, arr, arr. There wasn't a fence there, they'd probably come after me, right? Well, the idiom here is that no harm's going to come to Israel, so much so that a dog won't even bark at them. They're going to be totally left alone. He says that he's going to make a distinction. In fact, he tells the Pharaoh here, when he announces this, that it's going to be so that they know Yahweh makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. We've seen this distinction before. In fact, 2 other times, chapter 8, verse 22, with the plague of flies, it says, but on that day I will set apart the land of Goshen where my people are living, so that no swarm of flies will be there, in order that you may know that I, the Lord, am in the midst of the land. He does the same thing in chapter 9, verse 4, when the cattle are plagued and die, but the Lord will make a distinction between the livestock of Israel and the livestock of Egypt, so that nothing will die of all that belongs to the sons of Israel. God makes a distinction. Now, he's only told us that twice before, but we know that in the plagues, there was always a distinction. Israel did not suffer. God did not pour out his wrath on Israel. He poured it out on Egypt. That was the whole point. He had made a distinction between Egypt and Israel. He showed favor to Israel and judgment to Egypt. So that was the way that God works. The result of all of this, if you look at verse 8, all of these your servants will come down to me and bow themselves before me, saying, go out, you and all the people who follow you, and after that I will go out. So Moses says that literally the officials are going to come and bow down before him, in essence, begging him, leave take your people out. Now think about this for a minute. We're always, and I think this is the same, probably even more so back in the days of Moses here, because they had gods for all the natural occurrences. Can you think what happened when you had some of these plagues, like the flies coming? And the Egyptian officials kind of going, well, how come we got all the flies and Israel didn't? Or how come we all got boils on us and they didn't? The natural tendency would be to come up with some kind of explanation for it, right? Some kind of natural explanation. We do the same thing here. In fact, even within the Christian church, so many times people try to explain some of the miracles we see in the Bible through natural means. Even there's a movie out on the Star of Bethlehem, and they try to prove the Star of Bethlehem is a real event in the Bible by trying to claim that it's some type of natural phenomenon and part of science, and they can prove it. Instead of just accepting the fact that it's probably a supernatural event, you know, or the crossing of the Red Sea. I've done a lot of research into the crossing of the Red Sea. Where did they cross? And, you know, all these examples that we find. Well, it really wasn't the Red Sea. It was a sea of reeds. You know, it was only 18 inches deep. And then, the typical answer to that is, wow, that really is a miracle then. The fact that God took Israel over across the sea of reeds and 18 inches of water, that's probably even a better miracle than the crossing of the Red Sea. Why? Because the whole entire army was drowned in 18 inches of water. But we kind of look for natural tendencies or natural things sometimes to prove supernatural events. This is one, I think it was designed by God to get them out of that mode, meaning there is no way for them to be able to explain. There is no natural way. They could maybe argue, well, all those frogs came up, and then after the frogs, because you're all dead, the foul smell, that's what brought the flies. Okay, yeah, you can maybe argue that, you know. But there is no way that Egypt could figure out some type of natural explanation for why you've got five boys in the household, and it's the first one that died. In the house next door, they've got four boys, and it's the first one that dies. And the house next door has two boys, and the first one dies. There is no way that they'd be able to explain this, and what it ultimately led them to do was to beg Moses to leave. But beyond that, what God was trying to establish was, I make a distinction. He made a distinction between Egypt and Israel. Egypt, who worshipped all the pagan gods, and Israel, who would be his people and would learn to worship him. He makes a distinction. Now, I'm going to cover this just briefly because I think it's probably important. I'll even admit, I've struggled with this myself. Why did God go to this length? It seems a bit immoral, wicked, unjust is what people have said, that God would kill firstborn children, innocent children in Egypt. Does anybody struggle with that a little bit? Meaning, of what we know about God with him being compassionate, and think about Jesus and his love for children. Does anybody struggle with the thought that God would go to these lengths where he would literally take the lives of children to force Pharaoh to release his people from Egypt? Couldn't God have done something else to do this? I wish I had a better answer than what I'm going to give you, but I think it's an answer that we have to be willing to accept. But when we think about what God was doing here, go back to chapter 4, verse 22. God is looking at Israel, who was his firstborn. Israel belonged to God, and he referred to them as his firstborn. And Pharaoh was treating Israel as if they were his. And he was enslaving them. He was harming them. And so God, when he looks at Pharaoh, he says, thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my firstborn son go that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn son. Now, the reason I bring that up is because God's judgment against Egypt, in many respects, was equivalent to what the sin was. Does that make sense? Pharaoh had enslaved God's people, his firstborn, and refused. And we have to remember that God gave Pharaoh 9 times to obey. When we consider the nature of the crime, and we consider the patience and the endurance and the long-suffering of God, it puts what he did here, I think, in better perspective. Now again, we might still sort of struggle with that a little bit. The other thing we have to keep in mind is that in the ancient Near East, especially among some of the kings and stuff, but especially within Egypt, oftentimes their kings were considered godlike or divine-like, and their own children were considered to be gods or godlike. And then when you put all this together and you see that what God is ultimately doing is he is trying to demonstrate to all of Egypt that he's the one true God and that these gods they worship are false gods. They don't control life. He controls life. Not just from the crops, but to fertility and everything else. So, it sounds harsh. And I'll have to admit that it sounds harsh even to myself that God would do what he did here, but I also know that God is just and he's righteous and that the penalty for sin is equivalent to the nature of that sin. If we remember what he says in Romans chapter 1, turn to Romans chapter 1 if you would. Romans chapter 1. Whoops, get there. Romans chapter 1, go down to verse 18, it says, "The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power, and his divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools in exchanging the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and four-footed animals and crawling creatures." What we basically see here is that the tendency of man is to look at creation and to worship creation instead of worshiping God. Or taking God and his perfect image of who he is and turning him into things like animals and crawling things. Isn't that exactly what Egypt did? They turned God, if you will, into multiple gods, all looking like animals and insects. Remember the frog god and the locust god and all that weird stuff? Ultimately, what we see in this last plague here is this is what it would take for Egypt to see God as totally and completely sovereign, as the God of all gods, Yahweh. I'm convinced that if that had happened at any point prior to this, God would not have had to have done what he did in the 10th plague. God doesn't do more than he has to do. He's not a God. We've seen that he's been temperate here. He's been slow to anger. He's been good in some respects. Even when he knew that Pharaoh would renege on his deal to let the people go, God still stopped the plague. And again, I think when we look at this last plague and we ask the question, wow, how could God take the lives of these innocent children? Because that's what was necessary. And it fit what was happening. And so, again, it's maybe hard for us sometimes. This is an argument I've heard from others that when they try to say the Bible is just a bunch of stories, and they're like, well, any God that's as mean as the old God, and you ask them for an example, well, what did God... Oh, remember, he killed the kids in the last plague, you know? That's what they argue, and it's because they don't understand the holiness of God or the righteousness, but they also certainly don't understand the whole story and everything God had done and why he took the life of the first children. This, what it took Egypt to recognize that he was Yahweh, and for Pharaoh to recognize that he was the one true God. So, again, maybe I muddied the waters a little bit in terms of this, but I think it's a question that we have to wrestle with when we see God do things like this that we might question and say, wow, that just, you know, when God, during the conquest, and we saw this when we studied the conquest, and they would go in and completely kill all the inhabitants of a city. God did command that at times, because it was a judgment against those cities. And the other thing we have to kind of keep in mind is that while in the New Testament, most of the focus is on individual sin and salvation, in the Old Testament, the focus is much more corporate. God deals with Israel as a corporate body. And in some respects, judgment is corporate, meaning the sins of some are paid for by the nation. And God would judge nations that way. Think about it here with America. You know, I think sometimes what we see happening is God's judgment upon us. And everybody, even Christians, sometimes pay the price for that, right? So I don't know if that helps or hurts or muddies the water. The only solace I have in it is that as I think about what David says about seeing his own son, when David lost his first son with Bathsheba, how or why? Because of the sin with Bathsheba. Did that child deserve to pay the penalty for that? No. But it was a consequence of David's sin. But what did David say? David said he would ultimately be reunited with him. What we understand about God and his salvation is that a child who is taken is with him. So I'm convinced that as God went through Egypt and took the lives of these firstborn, my heart and understanding of Scripture says that he took them to be with him. They would not have been raised, at least the young ones, those taken as children, would not have been raised in a pagan culture which may have ultimately led them to hell. Is that a consolation we can use? Is that what we call a rescue mechanism? Maybe so. But think about it. We have people who have suffered the loss of a child, like the Diedrichs, who lost a child at birth. Where is that child today? Absolutely convinced that child is with Heavenly Father. So, again, I may have muddied the waters there a little bit, but at the same token, I think it's a question we have to ask, because it was a brutal thing. But this is what it took for Pharaoh in Egypt to finally say, take him and go. Leave. We recognize who you are as Yahweh. So, just as God's sovereignty ensured his favor upon Israel and his judgment upon Egypt, I think the same is true for us. Think about it. You know, we live in a world that is just wicked, and God will judge the world. But because of our relationship with Jesus Christ, we'll experience his favor. And it's because he's sovereign. He will judge those who deserve to be judged, and he will give life to those who know Jesus Christ. That's the way that it's going to work. God's favor upon Israel was something of his own will. He said, Deuteronomy chapter 7, the Lord did not set his love on you or choose you because you were more in number than any of the peoples. In fact, you were the fewest of all people, but because the Lord loved you and kept the oath which he swore to your forefathers. Someday, as God judges this world, we will experience his favor. Why? Because he chose to love us. It's all a part of his sovereignty. If I had to rely on who I am to receive God's favor, I'd be screwed. But because he's sovereign, I can know that someday, as I'm standing before him and he separates the sheep from the goats, that I'll experience his favor because he's sovereign. Last thing I want to see here is that Yahweh's sovereignty ensured his purpose was accomplished according to his plan. Look at verses 9 through 10. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, so that my wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Moses and Aaron performed all these wonders before Pharaoh. Yet the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the sons of Israel go out of the land. Again, I think these are somewhat parenthetical because they haven't really happened yet, but this actually reflects what Moses was told by God back in chapter 7, verses 3 and 4. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart that I may multiply my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. When Pharaoh does not listen to you, then I will lay my hand on Egypt and bring out my hosts, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by my great judgments. Basically, what the Lord tells Moses here is, my hand is going to be put upon Egypt. My wonders will be multiplied in the land of Egypt so that they will know that I am Yahweh. And that's exactly the way that it all ultimately played out. On at least 10 occasions in the Bible, it refers to Yahweh hardening Pharaoh's heart for the purpose of multiplying his signs and wonders. This has all been about God revealing who he is. And we were told not just to Pharaoh, not just to Israel, in fact, not just to Egypt, the text says to the whole earth. It's interesting, you can go all over the world. Go to non-Christian cultures, Muslim countries and other places. It's amazing how much they understand or know at least about this story to some degree. God used it to reveal himself. Moses and Aaron did just as Yahweh had commanded and performed all the signs and wonders. And just as Yahweh said he would do it, he hardened the Pharaoh's heart so that he could continue to multiply those things. And what all of this reveals is that because Yahweh is sovereign, it always plays out exactly according to his plan. Everything we've seen, he promised it would happen a certain way, we've seen it play out that way, and it ends exactly the way that he said it would end. So what do we do with that ourselves? Well, just as God's sovereignty ensured that the events surrounding the Exodus would play out exactly according to his purpose and plan, his sovereignty ensures that his purpose and plan for us in this world will also play out according to his plan. I get discouraged sometimes when I look around and I think, you know, here in America, church is kind of imploding in some respects. I've been listening to a series I just told Dustin and Matt this morning, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. It was about Mark Driscoll and his empire that he built and everything and how it collapsed. But so much of what they talk about in this podcast is just sort of the nature of evangelical Christianity around the United States and why is it that we have these big mega churches being built but a lot of small churches are dying and falling apart, and why is it that the church is so much less effective today here in the United States than it is in other parts of the world where Christianity is kind of growing and exploding. And it gets a little discouraging at times until I sit back and go, well, wait a minute. God is sovereign, which means none of this is out of his control. God is doing exactly what he set out to do, and he will continue to do it. I get discouraged sometimes when I think, where is Jesus coming back? Because he said he would come back, but I know that he will because it's all going to work out according to God's purpose and plan. And there's a certain amount of satisfaction in that, but there should also be encouragement in that as well. You know, we have this book here that's filled with God saying what he would do and actually doing it, don't we? And yet sometimes we get a little bit discouraged. But we got a whole book that says he does what he says he's going to do. We shouldn't really get discouraged. And again, I go back to Moses and Aaron. I would imagine that Moses at this point, when God said, all right, one more plague, that Moses probably went, okay. Because he didn't know how long it was going to last. You know, we saw him already get a little bit discouraged. The first time he went, and Pharaoh didn't respond positively, and he starts to whine to God a little bit. We see him settle down a little bit and just keeps doing what the Lord says to do. But I would imagine at this point, Moses probably was thinking, okay, Lord, one more, one more. I'll share this one last thing here. I've been studying, obviously, quite a bit ahead. And what's kind of cool is when Jethro goes to visit Moses, it starts off by saying that Jethro heard all that God had done to deliver Israel from Egypt. But I love the fact that in the middle of that, when he goes and he sees Moses, that it says that Moses recounted everything that God had done for Israel. But then he even includes in that even some of the difficulties and the suffering they had. But the impression you get from the text is that Moses was excited to share what God had done. And imagine that for a moment. Being told what God was going to do, and then watching God play all of that out, and seeing how God did exactly that. And I think that's why we see Moses in the wilderness have as much confidence as he does, because he goes from this individual who tries to give God all these excuses why he shouldn't go, to ultimately fighting on behalf of Israel, if you will. The confidence that Moses actually had in the wilderness, even in spite of Israel not always wanting to obey or do everything they're supposed to do, I believe he became convinced in God's ability to carry out and do exactly what he said he would do. And so for us, as we think about what's happening here, as we think about the animosity and some of the disdain that we see, some of the increased persecution, if you will, that's happening here, more and more people having a distaste for what's happening with Christianity or other things, we shouldn't be discouraged. If anything, we should be encouraged. God's working it out according to his plan, and because he's sovereign, it'll all work out according to his purpose and plan, and all we have to do is remain faithful. Amen?